Hi, and welcome to Embark. I'm Liz Solar, and today we're going to talk about leadership, what makes great leaders, how we can become better at leading and influencing, and leading our own lives as great examples to others. My guest today is Oren Lewin. Oren helps frustrated and overwhelmed entrepreneurs understand how they create their beliefs and emotions so they can change them in order to fuel high-performance behavior and massively increase their results. So we're talking about the stories that we might have heard when we were younger that we continue to tell ourselves that a lot of times they're negative stories, certainly not helpful to us. So let's try to change them. Oren's expertise lies in the fields of personal development, faith and work, neuro-linguistic programming, also known as NLP, and emotional intelligence. Let's meet Oren Lewin. Hey.
Hey, good morning, Liz. Thank you very much.
Oren, you speak with people who aspire to leadership, you know, one way or the other, whether it's on a larger stage or just in their own lives, being able to lead themselves, so to speak. And during the summer, I read an article about a survey which was disturbing but not totally surprising. And that is that most world leaders are not looked at favorably. So most of them had favorability ratings of low 40% and less. So there seems to be either a leadership vacuum or a perception problem, or at least people are not connecting to these leaders. So what does that say about modern leadership? What are the problems that we're having with it?
That's a great question. That's a true leadership. So aside from doing what I do, I was certified by the John Maxwell team for a number of years ago. And so John Maxwell really was my segue into the coaching space. And I love his perception of leadership. Leadership is influence. Nothing more and nothing less. And the way that John Maxwell teaches is leadership is really, it's serving. And so for a leader who really is seeking to serve, to communicate, to be transparent, and to make a difference. And so for a leader in a country who really is asking the question, who's honest with their flaws or areas where they've made mistakes but are seeking to do better. I mean, unfortunately, as soon as a leader admits a mistake, that's not looked on favorably. If a leader would communicate it well, humility does always, at the end of the day, rule out. People do see that and they do generally respect that.
I wanted to follow up what you just said. My husband is an attorney and he often represents plaintiffs. And every once in a while, he doesn't enjoy doing this type of work, but he does medical malpractice. And he was saying that a lot of people feel compelled to sue someone in the medical community, not so much because of a bad outcome, because that can happen for reasons beyond somebody's expertise or care. Mm-hmm. But the major issue that people had, what made them upset and resentful, is the fact that somebody did not apologize to them, that someone didn't care enough to come to them, do some kind of outreach, whether it was an acknowledgement or an apology or just empathizing with them. And it shows how much we get it wrong. I think sometimes we really do want the, hey, I made a mistake.
As citizens, I think it's, you know, I remember back to the days of U.S. President John F. Kennedy. I mean, I don't remember. I wasn't there. But one of his famous quotes, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. It is somewhat, leadership is a huge responsibility. And I think as a citizen, it's easy to see the flaws in my own leadership. But when I read this quote, sometimes I think, maybe I need to look in the mirror. Maybe I need to start with myself. And am I being that citizen? Am I asking what I can do for my country? Am I seeking to serve and to be the best citizen I can? Or am I just looking to cast the blame elsewhere? I remember G.K. Chesterton, who was an author of the last century, when he was asked during a contest, they said, what's the number one problem in the world? And they wrote in and they asked him, Mr. Chesterton, what is the number one problem in the world? And he responded a very short letter. He said, dear sirs, I am. And according to rumor, he won the contest, because essentially I think it's so important for us to recognize, yes, our leaders, and I can be frustrated by poor leadership at the same as anyone, but at the end of the day, I really have to examine myself and see, okay, what are the things that I'm responsible for? What are the things that I'm able to do and able to change? The heart of leadership is personal development. And the heart of personal development is a person's beliefs and emotions. And when I learn to lead myself, to lead what I'm feeling, to lead what I'm believing about myself and about the world, that's really where the rubber meets the road. And so that's why, Liz, I'm so passionate about what I'm doing and to help a person really lead themselves well. It's lovely to do with good leadership, but even with when I'm in a position of poor leadership, the question is, how am I leading myself in this situation?
Most of us throw the blame on something else, someone else, and not look internally about what we can do to change that dynamic. Not that we're going to go out and solve all of the world's problems, but what can we do? What can we do within ourselves, within our small circles of influence, to be able to make things a little better than they are? And I do kind of believe in that butterfly effect or the ripple effect of the way the world works. You put good out there and it often comes back, but it often gets passed along as well.
Absolutely.
Why do you think, going back to John Kennedy, a very strong leader, charismatic, brave, handsome, somebody who came into the world with money and prestige and influence and power, but also used that to serve? His service in World War II, he performed incredible feats of bravery. You know, many of us think people are natural leaders. You know, we come into it and we just have that ability, that instinct to lead. What makes a great leader? Are they born or are they made?
I think the core of leadership in general is really a person who's able to lead themselves well. You can only lead people really as far as you yourself have gone. And if leadership really at the heart of it is influence, is making a difference in the lives of others. And if we're looking at great leadership, who are those who make the greatest positive difference? They are those who really start with themselves, not who cast the blame elsewhere, who's saying the problem is out there, the problem is my competitor, the problem is the other political party, but those who really take a long, hard look at themselves and say, hey, how can I make a difference and lead in this? I think the two core skills in leadership, Liz, are the ability to get things done. A leader carries that authority because we want them to actually make a difference where they're at. We want them to lead our organization, our business, our church, our nation forward. Another key part in leadership is being able to build trust and being able to build that relational side, that connection with people. And so that's an area that really requires a humility. This is really the soft skills of leadership, is the relational side of things, a side that I have found in my own personal life is so important. Those leaders that have made the greatest difference in my life have been those who I have felt that I could trust. And so I really listened to what they said, and I really opened myself up to being vulnerable with those kind of leaders. So I would say what makes a great leader, I think it's the ability to get things done, but also and especially the ability to build relationships, to build trust, and to connect with their followers.
I'm going to go 100% with that trust thing. Yes, getting things done, but trust, that's relationship building at its core. Goes back to our distrust of all these established institutions that we really did used to trust, maybe put too much trust in. And now we are much more skeptical about them. Now, you have had people in your life who have made a difference and been an influence on you and people that you have trusted. Tell me a little bit about John Maxwell's work. Share that.
So after high school, Liz, I was in the faith-based world, and I moved into 10 years of ministry. And so that was here locally, well, in Canada. I spent a year in Colorado and overseas. And during that time, I really had a deep sense of purpose. I really wanted to make a difference, to develop people, to help make the world a better place. And what I often found was I had difficulty really being able to build that influence, to be able to build those relationships. That was just something that, you know, coming out of my background and my small town community that wasn't so emotionally aware, that affected me. And so I had a real difficulty with that. And it was overseas in India for a period of 2.5 years. And my team leader, he gave me a book by John Maxwell called Winning with People. And I remember reading this book, Liz, and just pieces started falling into place for me, you know, of relationships. Oh, this is how trust was built in this relationship over here. This is what went wrong in that relationship. And I started understanding the pieces of relationships at that time. I picked up a couple more of John Maxwell's books, and I found out at that time that John Maxwell had a certification program. So I joined the John Maxwell team, it was called at that time. And there they gave a business model of speaking, coaching, and training. And I didn't know so much about it, but I knew that's what I want to do. And so I launched my business, which is called Lionheart Leadership, with the desire, as Maxwell has equipped me, to be able to pass that on to others. And Maxwell really has served as my foundation of personal development and of leadership. His specialties, if you could call it that, are in communications, relationships, and leadership, and equipping others. And so just a phenomenal leader. Actually, Inc.com named him the world's number one influencer on leadership.
No, thank you for sharing that. And I feel a little bit smarter now. Some of the areas that you work in, and this does require incredible trust, are team development and culture improvement. What are you finding in cultures? Because the strength of a team probably depends on that culture that has been created. What do you see in corporate cultures and the cultures among groups?
I'm working less teams and with groups and more with individuals, because what I have found over my time, as I mentioned earlier, the heart of leadership is personal development. And what I realized is the heart of personal development of a person's growth is really comes down to what they're believing and what they're valuing. And this creates a person's emotions. This is a person, the way that they're interpreting life, the way that they're showing up. And so has just such a massive difference on the person's life. Helping a person understand, what is my individual culture? What's the culture that I'm creating when I'm showing up? That's coming out of your values, and that's coming out of your behaviors and how people are also perceiving you. And so I think that's a great question is to ask yourself, what's my culture? And so I ask myself, what's Oren Lewin's culture? How do people experience me? And then work really out from there to the team level and the organizational level.
What are some of the tools that you like to use when you're working one-to-one with people? What do you see produces the most results for them to take a very good look at what they're thinking, how their emotions are affecting the way that they go about making decisions and presenting themselves to the world?
Well, the number one tool is really awareness. Before you can change anything, you have to be aware of it, right? And the funny thing is, so most people today, 80 or 95% of people believe that they are self-aware, right? But the truth is actually only 10 to 15% actually are. And so psychologist Tasha Yurick, she quipped, she said, on a good day, we are lying to ourselves about lying to ourselves. And I think it's good for a laugh. But I also think there is a truth in that. And so the reality is no one is perfectly aware, self-aware, or perfectly unaware. We are all on a spectrum. We all have blind spots. And so for me, it's a matter of, what are the blind spots that I have now? What are the biggest blind spots that I can work to decrease? And when I grow in that awareness, that then gives me an understanding of the different options I have, and I can make better choices. Instead of assuming that I know, really asking the question and seeking to understand myself.
It often helps to have somebody on the outside of us, helping us, lighting the way, so that we can really take a good look inside and ask the questions that need to be asked. And sometimes someone else is required to ask them of us, because we can't even, if we're so lacking in that self-awareness, we don't even know where to start with the questions, because we don't even realize it's a problem with us or a blind spot. Mm-hmm. In which ways do you work with people to help them become more self-aware?
And so we do have a number of different habits or tools to increase awareness. And actually, a number of these things I learned from psychologist Daniel Goleman and Travis Bradbury, which were two of the real forerunners in the areas of emotional intelligence. And so they have some great practices, such as listening to your body. And because for example, when you're anxious, if that's a difficult thing to really be self-aware of, sometimes you can pay attention to what your body is doing. When I start breathing, having short, quick breaths, that might be a sign, oh, there's something going on. Or when my hands get clammy, maybe there's something happening in my body. And so that would be one practice. And then also a big tool is journaling. Like, not to journal every day, don't to make it a ritual because you think you need to, but specifically journal when there's something that you need to process. When there's something that happened, an event, and you're like, I don't really understand what just happened, that would be a time. So you're journaling about a specific situation to really unpack it and to understand what's really going on. And then also to journal with a desire to learn and grow and apply, you know, to say, what are the things that I can take responsibility for? And if you're not asking these questions when you're journaling, it can turn into rumination. It can turn into blaming or negative patterns of thought, right? And so to continually come back to the question, what are the things that I can control? How can I lead myself forward here and understand myself better?
You had mentioned earlier that one of the lenses that you're performing your work is through your own stories. No matter what you believe in life, metaphysical or anything, you know, beyond this earthly realm, one thing that we share is a need for stories and the ability of those stories to more closely connect us. Tell me a little bit about how you're using storytelling in the work that you're doing.
So growing up in a small town with a small community, as a young boy, I would say I really did have a desire, as many young boys do, for adventure and excitement. But as I grew up, I guess the real world and what I came to understand, how I came to form my self-beliefs, was not so positive. I wouldn't say I was bullied in school or I had an unusual negative upbringing. I homeschooled until grade 5. And when I did then enter school, my math skills were behind. And so I always then felt academically like I was a little bit behind. When we got into the ages of the school where we played sports, we had a small school. So that was something that almost all the students did. And as I started playing sports and really trying my best, I was never a super gifted student. I was always the one on the benches cheering on the team. And also socially, I was never one of the popular kids. And so these things compounded, and also the community having these emotions were not something that were talked about. And especially among the men, right? I grew up among farmers and loggers, and these aren't things that you talk about. And so I was actually a casualty of this. And so just had a lot of difficulties growing up, understanding myself, and the world wasn't as bright as I imagined it could have been. I had a lot of negative self-talk. I felt overlooked. And because of those self-beliefs brought me into my adult world, that ended up continuing. I didn't really believe I could connect with other people or myself. I didn't really believe I could make a difference, though I really wanted to and worked towards it. I had this inner conflict for many years. So when I learned how to really process, how to come to the point of really liking myself and having a true confidence from the inside out, that's something I believe that is quite rare. And the way that I deal with it, helping a person to change the way that they believe. My peak performance course, this really comes out of, this has been my own journey. This has been my own, you could call it the hero's journey, the story format. And as I've come from a place of very low self-beliefs and low self-awareness to the point where I'm definitely not. And I love my life and I know how to connect with others. That's something really at the deepest levels that I love to equip others into and to help them form that confidence and that resourcefulness for themselves so that they can show up the way that they want to in their life.
Thank you for sharing that. It's not easy to go back and unearth things in our lives. And childhood, high school can be particularly painful for many of us. And we can have a hangover from those years in our lives that for some people actually last the rest of their lives. And they don't come into their own. They don't blossom into what they could be, what they want to be. It's an incredible thing that you have overcome, but also an incredible thing that you can share with people. And hopefully it doesn't take as many years, you know, working with you as perhaps your own journey did. And I don't mean to make light of it, because our own life's journeys can be a real struggle, depending on the stories that we've been told.
Mm-hmm. And see, I know how hard I had to work and how many of my own demons that I had to overcome. And there's a line from leader Simon Sinek. He said, "Let us be the leaders that we wish we had had." I want to be the leader that I wish I had had to really give others the tools so that they don't have to go through what I've gone through.
Perhaps there's something for parents or people who work with young children, because I think those first 7-8 years of life are so vital to our development. So much of who we are, who we become, can be found in those first, you know, like say 10 years of life. I picked up a couple of children from a camp, a daycare camp, and for 3, 4, 5-year-old kids. And there were a bunch of kids doing water play, Oren, and one kid was sort of, I don't know, either making fun of what the other kid was doing. And the teacher stopped and said, "What they like is what they like, and what you like is what you like. And there's no wrong way to do this."
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you like is the thing that is going to work for you. You know, we all think differently. There are some areas in life, and I think school is one place where we learn to conform. You know, we learn to conform better than anything else we learn from a formal education is how to conform, just the way schools are, you know, just the masses of kids and the lack of many adults. And I felt such gratitude towards this woman who was able to honor, like, "Hey, what you like, excellent. They like something else." And that's okay, too. You can still play together and appreciate that about each other.
Mm-hmm. And it's really good when there are teachers who really understand that and really can help children grow into an adult mindset. You know, sometimes, and this may be a personal and a controversial thing, but when parents say, "Oh, we don't really want to teach our child, you know, such and such. We want them to grow up and make their own choice." Well, no, that's why you're parents, right? We want to really give up. I have my baby, my first daughter is due in 6 weeks, Liz, and so that's really exciting.
Wonderful.
And so just so looking forward to that. But then also just the sense of responsibility. I want her to know everything that I know. I want to pass on everything so that she can stand on my shoulders, take what I am building as foundations and take that to the next level.
Right. And I used to kid, I would teach my kids things so they'd have something to rebel against in their adolescence. So, you know, we all come into the world and we live in communities and in families where we have points of view and we have opinions and we have ways of doing things, and they do get passed down, and children have to be taught. And really, it's up to us to find the most loving and constructive ways to show those things, to show them the world, because our kids have a front row seat into how the world works, because they're looking at our every move. Even if we think kids aren't paying attention, they certainly are. How are we going to behave? And what type of people, if we want the best for our kids, what do we want? I would love to see more programs that are suited for children that help kids with some of this stuff too, because there are a lot of parents who are just dropping the ball on showing their kids a way in disciplining them. And I don't mean punishing. I mean actually showing them ways that there are ways to behave in large groups and in communities, in a greater community, and still be able to retain what is unique and wonderful about them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have this birth happening in 6 weeks. What are your thoughts about what you give this child in light of the story that you had in the work that you do?
One cool thing that someone said is that that each parent is the right parent for their child. And so I know everyone comes into the parenting season with baggage. We all have things in our lives that we're not proud of, or things that have happened. And that is what it is, right? We're broken people in a broken world. But just to come in with a confidence and a humility to say, okay, I'm in over my head. I'm ready. I'm willing to learn. But at the same time, the confidence saying, there is no better parent for my child than I am. I'm excited, Liz, because of where I've come and the growth that I've gone through over the years, that my daughter, she's not going to have to struggle with the same things that I did, because I'm going to teach her the great self-awareness and awareness of her values and what's really makes her as an individual her. I'm going to help her to understand, to be aware of what are the things that she's believing about herself in such and such a situation, and how is that affecting her, so that these often invisible things are on the surface, and so that she can really lead herself well and really make an impact on the world, and to be able to change those for herself and for others that are around her.
There is something in you are a very kind person. I don't doubt that this baby will come in to a really welcoming environment and in a lot of gentility. I had seen something in your literature about emotional agility, because I think it's really important that mm-hmm. we be agile in that way. I think you had said something, and please correct me if I don't have it right, use the power of negative emotions to cultivate positive momentum. How do you do that? Because you're starting from a negative place.
Yeah. So every time we have an emotion, everything that you're sensing and everything that you're feeling, it has an important message for you, right? Your body is kind of giving you messages, and it's giving you signs. Now, unfortunately, because we're not really taught to interpret those, negative emotions are received in a very negative way, right? And because we're not taught to deal with them, that leads to, you know, depression, or that leads to coping mechanisms. When we're taught to slow down and to listen and to say, what is the message that this emotion is sending to me, right? Possibly, so anger is saying, hey, there's an injustice here, right? And I actually need to move to correct this in a healthy way. Possibly, it's saying, hey, I'm angry, but maybe I shouldn't be angry, and maybe there's something that I can learn and really grow and adjust. Possibly, there's a guilt. And that guilt may actually tell you positively that there's something that you really value. I remember feeling guilty for violating one of my values. And of course, then the feeling is very negative. But actually, when you reframe it, it's, hey, actually, I do really take this seriously. I do really value this this thing that I have violated. And so every negative emotion, if you pay attention, it's saying something. And so as we can learn to understand and then to reframe it, right? Understand the message and then frame it in an empowering way. So instead of, you know, this is a really difficult situation, therefore I'm depressed, it's saying, no, this is a really difficult situation, and it is given to me to actually help me to grow into a stronger person. It's actually forming in me skills. Your failure is an important part of life. Number one, really understanding what the message that negative emotion is. And then number two, reframing it in an empowering way and taking responsibility for it really helps us then to use our negative emotions as fuel.
If people wanted to get in touch with you, if they want to find out more about you, Oren, which I'm sure they would, how do they do that?
Yeah, so my website is lionheartleadership.ca. Well, I'm primarily on LinkedIn, so I would love to connect with anyone. And Liz, I also do monthly have a webinar that happens where I go through actually this process of reframing negative emotions and a specific practice called parts integration.
Please send those links and those will all be on the liner notes.
Thank you very much, Liz. And thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here. And there are links to Oren's website and his social in the liner notes. Next week on Embark, I'm back with my pod partner and political frenemy, good friend, Jack Monson, and we're going to talk about reasons to be cheerful. I mean, it's Thanksgiving, right? Knowing how busy life gets and how many choices that you have, I thank you for the privilege of your time and hope to see you next week on Embark.